welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. So we've done a few episodes on Oscar Best Picture winners, but the Oscars has been and gone now. It's all in the past. You listeners will know who's won by now. I don't know. We're pre-recording ahead of time. But anyway, I thought it was time to kind of mix things up a bit. So this week, we're going to take a look at a 1960s superhero film, namely Batman from 1966, which stars Adam West and Burt Ward. And who have I got to join me on this episode? Let's see. Holy podcaster, it's Darren Mooney. How's it going, Darren?
That's awesomely alliterative over here, Carl. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's quite a change of pace. Although, you know, this was the year that the first superhero movie was nominated and or, depending on what happened, won. I suspect it did not win, in the Best Picture race. So it's sort of timely in that regard, I think.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention that, so this is the year that Black Panther is, and we didn't know this when we set up the recording, but it's quite, you know, fortuitous, I guess. But Black Panther got into the Best Picture race, and yeah, it seems like it probably isn't expected to take home the big prize, but still represents kind of a step forward for specifically the Marvel films, but superhero films in general.
Yeah, in terms of like populism and in terms of like, and also to be fair, in terms of the Oscars as well, because the Oscars have had, and you probably talked about this a little bit, you know, in the earlier episodes, but like the Oscars have had this crisis of identity where they're trying to figure out how to balance being this sort of art house, sort of like darling, sort of like, you know, the award season fair, the earnest, very respectable button down drama starring actors who have honed their craft over years, primarily known for stage work, by writers and directors who are sort of auteurs who are sort of working in those circles, with the idea of like also honoring films that people have seen. I mean, the Best Popular Film Oscar fiasco that happened earlier in the year is a great example of that. And like, there's a lot of chatter about how this year's, you know, nominees are not great, and two of them at the very least are far from great. But I think that there's something interesting in the nominees in that you have an Oscar panel this year, you know, or had, retroactively speaking, including films that people have seen. And it was kind of nice to see Black Panther, which, you know, wouldn't make my top, I think it made my top 30 films of the year, not my top 20. But it was like, it's a film that everybody genuinely loves. And like, I look at the passion out there for it and like the sheer joy that people have taken from it. And it's hard for me to begrudge that. And it's really kind of cheerful for me, somebody who doesn't think it's like one of the 20 best films of the year, to see it honored and acknowledged as such. It means a lot to me to see that joy recognized in a way, you know?
Yeah, and this kind of crisis of identity you spoke of with the Oscars, that it can kind of be traced back a little way to Batman, can't it? And The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's film, where a lot of people really wanted that film to get into the Best Picture race that year. If I remember rightly, it was a particularly weak crop of Best Picture candidates that year. The Dark Knight was kind of shut out, but then that seemed to directly or indirectly lead to a few kind of changes in the rules and how many nominees they allowed and that kind of thing, didn't it?
It was. There were seen as being four set nominees. I can't remember them off the top of my head now, but there were four agreed, like 100% dead cert nominees, in the same way that this year everybody knew A Star Is Born and Roma were going to be nominated. And then there was a fifth slot. And in the fifth slot, people reckoned that, you know, a lot of people were like, it's going to be The Dark Knight because that's a hugely respected blockbuster, record-breaking movie. It's also very respected and very sort of, you know, loved and got great critical reviews. And, you know, there's some other people who are like, well, actually, maybe it could be WALL-E, because WALL-E's also, it's an animated film, which is a little unconventional. You know, Beauty and the Beast was, I think, the last example of an animated film to get a Best Picture nomination. And the Oscars created the best animated film to prevent that from ever happening again. But people were like, it could be The Dark Knight or it could be WALL-E. Turned out it was The Reader. And one of my abiding memories of that Oscar ceremony is like Hugh Jackman's big show-stopping, clearly written well ahead of the nominees being announced, Oscar opening number, which includes a verse for every single film that had been nominated for Best Picture. When he gets to The Reader, his section on The Reader consists of him riding a Batmobile declaring, "The Reader, I haven't seen The Reader. I was going to see it later, but my Batmobile took longer than I thought to design. I went to the theater, but there was a line of people seeing Iron Man a second time." And that was kind of a moment where you sort of realized that the Academy sort of had this realization of the fact that it was kind of disconnected. Because, I mean, this was around the time, I think 2008 was the year in which the Oscars had the lowest rated telecast at that point. Also correspondingly had the lowest grossing Best Picture nominees cumulatively in the entire history of the awards ceremony. And you're right, you saw this push towards expanding out the number of nominees, but also expanding and diversifying the membership of the Academy as well, in order to get a more representative thing. And I think that this year is a year where you've really seen that pay off. This is a much stronger more reflective Oscar pool of where cinema is in 2018, 2019 than, say, the 2008 one was, as, you know, where cinema was at that moment in time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, the 2008 one, well, the ceremony was in 2009, I think, but the 2008 films. So The Reader, like you say, Milk, Frost Nixon, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and Slumdog Millionaire, which won for Best Picture.
Oh, dear God, that was an awful year.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to the issue of, like, The Dark Knight and stuff before we go at the end, but I think I would suggest it's held up much better than any of those films, to be fair. But anyway, Darren, so the reason you're here, the reason I've asked you here is I know, obviously wanted to have you back on the podcast. Longer-term listeners will remember you from Gilda last year and from the crossover episode we did, Double Indemnity, with your podcast for 250, your podcast with Andrew Quinn. But I know you're a big superhero fan. And I know you're a big comic book fan, so I thought, what can we do to kind of, you know, entice Darren back? So Batman from 1966, I think Batman the movie, it's released as in home video, isn't it, in various formats. So it's kind of, you know, some people would know it as Batman the movie, I think. But I also thought this was a nice chance to just consider Batman, you know, his history, really. So where did it all start for Batman? Where does it begin? I mean, as I understand it, and I'm not a huge comic reader, I haven't read, you know, many Batman comics over the years, but he kind of emerges at an interesting time, doesn't he? Just before the world is kind of engulfed in crisis across the globe with the Second World War, Batman's kind of just before that, which is about the same sort of time as someone like Superman, I think, is like the year before Batman starts. Is that right?
That is indeed. Superman is sort of like Superman's the original superhero. He's the archetypal superhero. And he's very much, he's the character who I believe inspired the editors at National Comics, which become DC Comics, that they wanted more characters like that. And like, you have this interesting dichotomy from the start. They're the two almost founding fathers of the kind of superhero genre as it begins. And you have this contrast that exists between the two as they go on. And I mean, you know, Batman, Superman constantly playing off one another. But the origin of Batman is kind of interesting in the sense that, like, Superman, and again, this is me, and I'm probably going to wax lyrical and feel free to tell me to stop at any time. But it's like, Superman is this idea of the ultimate American creation. He's the immigrant story. You know, I mean, you can make comparisons about how he's Jesus or he's Moses. You know, like, obviously the Donner movies and Superman Returns both have those sort of parallels in there. But to me, Superman's always been this archetypal American icon. He's the immigrant. He's the man who comes from the old world. And I mean, you see that in, for example, like Man of Steel is a deeply, deeply flawed movie. But it has that sense of like Superman as an immigrant from Europe or this old world dominated by bloodlines and destiny and class structures and who's cast out into the world and thrown into like the middle of Kansas, this world that is still forming and trying to decide what it's going to be. And he discovers that if he has enough power of will, if he believes enough in what's right, if he adopts the values of the family into which he's raised, and if he becomes one of the people with whom he lives, he can accomplish anything. It's the ultimate immigrant story. It's the idea of a character who is capable of doing great things and literally ascending. You know, you can go from, you can literally fly, you can leap single buildings in a tall bound, you know, tall buildings in a single bound, that sort of stuff. And what's interesting about Batman in contrast to that, and again, I've always kind of read this, it's the idea that Batman is this weirder, darker, more New English sort of gothic character. He's more rooted in sort of his colonial past. I think, like, for example, Bill Finger, who I think gave him the name Bruce Wayne, picked the name Bruce Wayne to suggest Robert Bruce the Scottish Patriot, for example. Wayne, you know, being a gentry name, for example. He wanted something tied back to colonialism, and he sort of, you know, I think he cites like Adams and Hancock as possible alternatives either. But the idea is that Wayne, he lives on, you know, he lives in this stately Wayne Manor. He lives on this estate. He's from old money. He's got this sort of, he feels like a creation that could easily have come from the work of, say, Edgar Allan Poe or, you know, even like Lovecraft, where he's this idea of this guy, Arkham Asylum is obviously when it later comes from Lovecraft. But you have this idea of Batman as this sort of like monstrous, creepy figure who exists. I mean, Bob Kane was inspired by the work of Leonardo da Vinci. And so you have this idea of Batman as something more horrific and more monstrous. I mean, even if you look at, say, the influences around, like, the creation of his villains, the Joker, to pick one example, is based on The Man Who Laughs, that sort of Conrad Veidt character from, you know, sort of European cinema in the 30s, this sort of expressionist German monster. The early recurring villains included, like, Hugo Strange and the Monster Men, who were, like, these sort of, again, these gothic monstrous creations. And so Batman sort of at the start kind of existed at this sort of, like, halfway point between the emerging superhero genre where he had like a Batmobile and he had like the bat signal and stuff like that. But also this rich tradition of sort of horror and sort of, you know, that was tied and rooted in like pop cultural history. And again, like, it's worth noting, by the way, before we talk about this, Bob Kane is credited as Batman's creator, and he's credited on absolutely everything involving Batman because his, I believe his father was a very good lawyer, but he negotiated a very tight contractual agreement with National Comics when he created Batman, with Detective Comics, which was the publication in which Batman first appeared. And so everything is credited Batman created by Bob Kane. Bob Kane is a controversial and divisive figure, even more so than Stan Lee, whose authorship is subject to debate. Kane's original conception of Batman was going to be a character who wore red tights, had a domino mask, would swing from a rope, and he would have, instead of a cape, he would have wings on his back. It was actually Bill Finger, who sadly passed away before his work could be acknowledged, who came up with the idea of changing the colour scheme from red to grey, of giving him a cowl instead of a domino mask, of giving him a sort of a cape rather than wings, and also creating many of the sort of supporting characters that people know and love about the Batman mythos. So it's kind of very important that Bill Finger and another artist as well are sort of properly acknowledged in the history of him. But it's kind of fascinating because he is, Batman is this kind of hybrid of people like, you know, these pulp heroes like the Phantom, the Shadow, Dick Tracy, but also even going back to like Penny Dreadfuls like Sherlock Holmes and stuff like that. And he has this flexibility built into him, which to me is a large part of what I love about Batman and why I think Batman has endured in pop culture in the way that he has. It's very trite and it's very stock to say, like, the reason why Batman, and let's be honest, Batman has had a much easier time than Superman since around 1980, roughly, would be the point at which their sort of their paths diverge, at which like you actually start having a debate and your answer is like, who's the most popular superhero ever? And your answer isn't always Superman. And I think part of the reason for that is because Superman's great. I absolutely adore Superman. I think he's fantastic. I think he's iconic. I think he's brilliant. I think he's massively underappreciated. And I think he's very hard to write particularly well. But I think a large part of that is because he's an archetype and he's stuck in a very particular way. Where the advantage that I think Batman has, and this will be a nice segue into talking about like Batman 66 in particular, is that Batman is a character who has a flexibility built into him in terms of genre. You can do literally anything with Batman. You can pop him into almost any kind of story with any kind of tone, and he will work amazingly well. Like, just think of like, even without getting into the comic books, think of the adaptations of Batman in popular cinema. You have the 1940s serial, you have the 1966 TV show and movie, you have, like, Tim Burton's Batman, which is, like, a Tim Burton movie that just happens to have Batman in it. You have the Joel Schumacher movies, which are campy, silly. You have Batman the Animated Series, which is a bit more sort of 40s noir. You have the, like, the Dark Knight trilogy, which is basically this take on the War on Terror that happens to use Batman in it as well. You have the Brave and the Bold, the TV show, which is more camp and playful. You have all these sort of things that you can do with Batman, all these sort of stories that you can tell. And he has this sort of flexibility that you can't imagine with Superman. You can't slot Superman into a, like, film noir story, for example. You can't pop Superman into a horror story. You can probably put Superman into a space opera or something like that. You can put him into, you can't really do like low level urban crime drama. He's not as flexible as Batman is. And I suspect that's one of the reasons why Batman has endured the extent that he has, if that makes sense.
It does. And let's think a bit about like 1960s Batman then, because I mean, for me, growing up in the 90s, effectively, my first encounter with Batman would have been seeing reruns of the 1960s TV series with Adam West and Burt Ward. But I know, you know, obviously there are comics around this time too, and there's a good write-up of the Batman TV series by Matt Zoller-Seitz in his book with Alan Sepinwall, TV, the book. They list Batman the series as the 82nd best American 82nd? TV show of all time, I think, yeah, which is pretty good. But yeah, he says, even in 1966, comics were already moving away from the naive aesthetic that formed the core of Batman's style. So as someone who is not really, you know, familiar with what was going on in comics at that time, what does he sort of mean by that?
The issue with Batman is Batman was quite popular during the 40s. All superheroes were very popular during the war, World War II. And I mean, there are all sorts of like psychological, historical arguments about why that is. Like, you could argue that America at that time needed these archetypes that embodied a certain sort of heroic value and virtue. And I mean, like, you know, you have Batman, the serial from the 1940s, which is chock full of racism about Japanese saboteurs and stuff like that, which very directly ties the character Batman into this idea of America fighting, you know, the Second World War and the need for good to triumph over evil. In the wake of the Second World War, and this is like in terms of comic book history, like you traditionally divide it into the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and the Bronze Age. Golden Age is the war. Then there's this sort of gap where it's sort of like where superheroes sort of fall out of fashion. And you have this thing where I think Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman are the only superhero characters to be continuously published through the 40s and 50s. And this is the thing, even while that was happening, the sales were waning. And there were several reasons for this. Most obviously, the stories weren't particularly great or inspired. You had this huge challenge as this public debate started taking place about superheroes. Because like Batman, the early Batman stories and the early superhero stories were quite graphic and violent. And they were quite dark and disturbing. I point out, you know, Hugo Strange and the Monster Men, a villain who is actually literally modeled on the Man Who Laughs. This guy whose face is stuck, I believe, due to cyanide. And is stuck in this sort of Richter grin. You have the Joker as a murdering psychopath. But you also have, like, again, you have this Seduction of the Innocent, which was published in 1954 by psychologist Frederick Wortham, which argued that comic books were basically corrupting the minds of our children. It's the moral panic that you get over absolutely everything. You saw it with film, you saw it with television, you heard it with rap music in the 90s, you hear about social media now. It's this idea of this art form that's emerging is new, we don't entirely understand it, and we're worried about how it's won't somebody think of the children, basically, is the argument. And Wortham's argument had a number of profound effects on Batman, in particular, on superhero comics in general and Batman in particular. First of all, it kind of codified. It led to the adoption of the Comics Code Authority, which is interesting on a number of levels. That's the one where you had basically comic book publishers getting together and self-censoring to avoid any sort of external regulation and imposing a code which basically said, look, you know, no excessive violence, clearly defined heroes and villains, no ambiguity, no nuance, nothing that could possibly be misconstrued as anything but the harshest condemnation of crime. Which, by the way, is why, for example, you have the Batman the 66 having the parody of Batman as this almost deputized lawman. I think that Semple, who wrote the Bible for the show, famously wrote that, like, Batman must never be seen to break the law. Even when, dealing with an urgent crime, he must park properly. And sort of that level of kind of writing. You had Batman being adopted by Gotham City Police as a deputized authority. In the movie, he hosts a press conference, just to keep everybody up to date. He has the Batcopter on the roof of the Gotham City Police Department, for example. Like, that sort of stuff all comes from the comics, where at the time it was like, we don't want to be seen to encourage vigilantism. And again, Batman 66 is parodying that. But it's parodying that by playing it absurdly straight. You also had, around the same time, the idea of Wortham suggesting that there was something, and then this is one of those jokes that everybody tells about Batman and Robin, which is like, well, isn't it a bit strange that reclusive billionaire lives alone in his mansion with his doddery old English butler and this, like, young boy who he makes prance around in short shorts or tights? Isn't there maybe something a little bit suspicious about that? Which is one of the oldest jokes that people tell about comic books. But Wortham suggested that, yes, comic books were making children gay. And so as a response, you had this moral panic where you had all of a sudden this introduction of all these women into Batman's life, where all of a sudden it was like, yeah, he's totally straight. He's dating characters like, It's Silver St. Cloud or Batwoman, for example, in the 50s. And then the pre-Barbara Gordon Batgirl. And, you know, obviously Batgirl when she was introduced in Batman 66 as well. But you have basically this idea that, yeah, no, he's totally, absolutely 110% straight. And you have, like, again, you have the Batman 66 playing with that ridiculously. I think in the TV show, you have them in the same room, but in separate beds. That sort of thing going on. And there's this sort of, like, awkwardness around that exists. But even just in general, like, with these limitations imposed, there was what kind of stories could you tell with Batman was a challenge that writers faced. So you started seeing a lot more of the outlandish kind of, like, what-if stories or, like, fantastical stories where Batman's abducted by aliens or he has rainbow cowls or he sort of experiences these things that make him act like a jerk. And, like, this is interesting because, like, I talked about the point where Batman eclipses Superman around 1980 in the mid-80s or whatever. In the 50s, Superman was much more suited to these kind of stories. Superman was very much adaptable in terms of you could tell any sort of weird science fiction story you wanted about Superman because he's an alien from outer space. And so you can do things where he splits in half and there's a red Superman and a blue Superman. Or you can do one where he discovers he's dying and he writes a message to the world on the side of the moon. And Superman's a character who's adaptable like that. Batman in the 50s. Why would you read a Batman comic where he's abducted by aliens or he kind of fantasizes about Robin dying over and over and over and over again? And so the comics got sort of stuck in a rut. And by 1964, I think, there was suggestion that they were worried about the sales of Batman to the point where they were considering cancelling the book. And at that point, editor Julius Schwartz came in and he defined what was known as the New Look era. And this was around the time, this was the 60s, so we're well out of like the difficulty that comic books had in the 50s where nobody was buying them. At this point, you have over across the street, you have Marvel comics, which are breaking out with the work of like Jack Kirby and Stan Lee on titles like The Fantastic Four and Spider-Man. And what they're doing is they're finding a way, a new way of writing superhero comics in the 60s that reflect the youth tastes of the time. Part of that is that they set them all in New York. So you have stories like the X-Men going down to Greenwich Village to listen to some hippie play a guitar. But a large part of that's also through making the characters more relatable and organic. Peter Parker's famous, you know, issues that he has that were relatable to any teenagers who were reading, trying to figure out who they were. The X-Men feeling like outsiders in the same way that every teenager feels like an outsider. That sort of stuff. And you had, like, at the same time, DC was trying to figure out how to do that with its own characters. It wasn't quite as good. And so I suspect part of that is down to the fact that they were very successful in the 40s with the characters they had and so never had to kind of innovate. So you got characters like the Green Lantern and the New Flash, who were adaptations of these old Second World War characters, but who were like more science fiction and more high concept-y. So, you know, the Green Lantern can make anything with a green light, and Flash can run very fast, which allows you to do all sorts of science fiction concepts like time travel and multiple dimensions and stuff. With Batman in the 60s, you had this weird push towards making him seem relatively grounded while also completely wholesome. And that's where you end up with the sweet spot of Batman 66, where you have this, like, even in 1964, when this was being published, or 1966, when the thing was being released, you had, like, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby telling these stories about, like, the Thing contemplating the nature of his existence and worrying about who he is as a person and the fact that he will never be able to hold somebody's hand in the way that he used to. Happening over at Marvel Comics, you have like Peter Parker worrying about paying the bills or what happens if his aunt gets sick, or like feeling anger and rage inside himself at how the other kids treat him. These stories that are very relatable and human. And at DC Comics, you have, well, Batman is now a fully deputized law officer who parks properly and doesn't cross a double yellow line. And you have this sort of disconnect. And that's, I think, sort of what Sellers Eats is sort of getting at there, which is this idea of, like, it seeming almost a little bit out of date by the time it was published in the 60s. And it's kind of like, because you look at Batman 66, it's emerging at the height of counterculture. And you have this wonderful parodic element of Batman as this ultimate straight man, where he's a guy who dresses in a cape and cowl, but who, like, I think that the great quote from Adam West, the moment that Adam West decided that he wanted to play Batman, is the moment he read the pilot script to the series. And he said he features Batman wandering into a bar in full costume, ordering a glass of milk and saying that he'll sit in the corner because he shouldn't want to draw attention to himself. Which is like, that's the quintessential Batman 66 moment. It's this parody of understanding that Batman is somehow incredibly weird and odd, but somehow so much squarer than the decade happening around him. And I kind of love that dichotomy about it.
Yeah, and just before we get to the film, just another word on the TV series, really, which I just noticed actually is out on Blu-ray, which I didn't realise, but that's tempting. But yeah, a lot of nostalgia for that programme for me. You know, very fond memories watching it as a child. At the time, I'm not sure how aware I was of this kind of tongue-in-cheek aspect to it, you know, because when I was a kid, I was really into stuff like Thunderbirds and Stingray, you know, the Gerry Anderson kind of puppet shows, you know, really adored the kind of earnest, square-jawed heroism of those programmes. And I suspect, I can't quite remember, but I think my enjoyment of Batman was probably, you know, taking things at very face value at that time. So I'd love to go back and watch it now. But I remember really enjoying, like, the serialized element of it, you know, the kind of cliffhanger endings and just the kind of prevailing sense of, like, vitality on display. So you may have seen it more recently than me. Am I kind of misremembering those elements?
No, I mean, I think you're entirely on point. There's a number of things to note about, like, the Batman 66 TV show. And, like, to get the hard one out of the way first, which is, like, The episodes are incredibly formulaic. I bought that Blu-ray. Yeah. It's an amazing Blu-ray. It's fantastic. I absolutely adore it. I blazed through most of the set. It took me a little while to get through the end of it because, like, you do notice, particularly when you're watching them, like, again and again and again, there's a very strict formula that the episodes follow. You know, there's the phone call, there's the investigation, there's the celebrity villain, there's the death trap, there's the narration, there's the escape from the death trap using a bat, you know, prefix device that just happens to be on his belt. There's a fist fight, there's onomatopoeia. There's, like, I mean, it's very rhythmic and it's very structured. And, like, again, this is, like, 1960s television. This was not designed, they never assumed that A, you would be watching this again at all, but they never imagined that you would be watching this again at all, probably in binge watching mode. So it's not a problem with the show. It's absolutely 110%, you know, not an issue with the show as it was written and as it was performed, but it is an issue I find with consuming it today. That said, it is amazing. And in fact, there are two stories, maybe three stories in particular from the run that I would single out. Like, I have my own, like, again, I'm a massive Batman nerd, and I make no apologies for that, you know, except maybe to your listeners. But, like, I have this list in my head of, like, the top 50 Batman stories ever, you know? And, like, on that list, it's Batman stories from all media. So The Dark Knight is in there. Mask of the Phantasm's in there. Heart of Ice is in there. You know, that sort of stuff. It doesn't have to be comic books, although there's a lot of comic books in there. And there are three, like, classic Batman 66 episodes, which I would consider to be among the very finest Batman stories ever told. And the first one is the actual pilot, the two-part pilot with the Riddler, which is just an astounding piece of television because it's like, whoa, this is just amazing and vital and fun and exciting. It's the formula that every other episode does, but it's done for the first time and it's done with such zeal and it's infectious. And I remember watching it the day I got the Blu-ray with my roommate, and it was just like, we're grown men. We are both grown men. He is a much more mature individual than I am. He's probably a bit less into Batman. Doesn't have a comic book collection. But we were both enraptured by it. It was absolutely amazing. So that would be one of them. The other one is the Surf's Up two-parter, in which the Joker, and I absolutely, again, this is the 1960s-ness, the wholesomeness, the weird satirical quality of this, where the Joker enacts a plan to sabotage Gotham City's youth by installing vending machines that offer tests, like the answers to tests that are being conducted in college. The plan being that people will pass these without actually learning anything, and therefore the entire city's social structure will decay. But it culminates in a sequence in which the Joker challenges Batman to a surf off. And I mean, come on. If that doesn't get you excited, I don't know what does. And then the third and final one, and this is kind of interesting because it speaks to the legacy of Batman 66 in a way that people haven't really acknowledged. And I mean, we'll probably talk a little bit about the legacy of the film, the show later on, because it kind of, it's one of those things where it took a while, where people are a little ashamed of it for a little while, I think.
Cautious, yeah.
Cautious of it. And it was like this, you know, this defines Batman. This isn't really what Batman should be, which is an argument that I really hate. Any argument that is like, this thing shouldn't be this, is not an argument that I'm particularly engaged with. But his Honor the Penguin and Dishonor the Penguin, which is a two-parter in which, and again, fans of later Batman stories may find the basic premise familiar, in which the Penguin runs for mayor of Gotham City. An elaborate scheme which involves turning the people of Gotham against Batman. Gee, has this been used somewhere else, possibly in a more high-profile example? But again, it's the series firing on all sorts of, like, it's, you watch it as a kid and it's great fun because Batman punches a bunch of guys and they're brightly colored and you get the onomatopoeia, you get the words appearing in the air. And it's great fun. You know, it's like watching a comic book come to life. The production design is amazing. The strong use of colors, all that sort of stuff is fantastic. The dialogue could come from a 1960s comic book, that heavily overwrought narration, the use of alliteration, the, like, incredibly insane Deus Ex Machina kind of twists, including, like, the noble porpoise, that sort of stuff, which could all have come from a comic book in terms of style. But you also have this very biting thing that I didn't realize when I was... You're right, I didn't realize when I was watching as a kid, but when I come back and watch it now, it's like, wow, this is actually a really, really pointed show. I suspect that, like, parents watching it, you know, they probably didn't love it as much as we love watching Pixar. It probably got really annoying at points. But as an adult watching it, I imagine that there's part of it where you're going, yeah, this isn't so bad. Where it's like, well, who came up with the idea of making the Penguin Richard Nixon? Because that's an ingenious idea. So yeah, the show is fantastic. I would recommend the Blu-ray. You may want to pace out watching it, or you may want to order the, you know, kind of structure the order in which you watch it a bit more carefully than watching from beginning to end. But if you are interested, I think it holds up very well. I really, really do.
Right. So I guess what we're saying, though, you know, if it is functioning for different audiences on different levels, then perhaps a missing element that I didn't fully appreciate until recently is that in some ways that series seems to be calling back to those 1940s serials a little bit, which I've been watching a little bit of on YouTube. But things like the look of Batman, the voiceover, the cliffhangers seem to kind of be drawn from those. And I guess the thing is, that would have been in like living memory for a lot of viewers in 1966. But these days, you know, not many people are likely to have seen the 1940s stuff, I'd say.
This is the thing where you have, again, for a long time, comic book fans were very ashamed of Batman 66 because it made it seem like a joke. And you had this, again, we talked about like how you had this wholesome comic book quality in like the 50s with the Comics Code Authority and Seduction of the Innocent. You had this sort of backlash where comics all of a sudden had to be whole and pure and that sort of thing. And in the 80s, you had this counter movement with like the Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen, where you had this sort of push, or even like Frank Miller's Daredevil and Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, if you want to pick two other examples of kind of monthly in continuity publications. We had this idea that like comic books were now mature and, you know, they were taken seriously as an art form. And it was like, they're not just for kids. Which sometimes awkwardly translates as they're not for kids at all, which is, you know, something that I'm not entirely comfortable with, and I think speaks to an insecurity in some cultures or some fan cultures. But I think that it's absolutely interesting that like Batman 66 sort of suffered a little bit because of that sort of backlash, where people were like, it's not really Batman, it's for kids. But if you watch it, and I think you're entirely right when you say those elements are taken from 1940s serials. Those, the William Dozier, who is the producer on the show, but is also the uncredited narrator, who does those like, tune in, same bat time, same bat channel, which is very much evoking those old sort of 40s serials, which again, like, my father would have remembered watching. Now, he wouldn't watch them in the 40s because, you know, obviously I'm not that old. But in Ireland, this is like that joke in Family Guy where it's like, stop playing that 80s American music, which we just got last week. But like, again, he would have seen them in the 60s where those reels would have been playing in Irish cinemas. But yeah, that sort of quality that you don't really have anymore, where you have the to be continued aspect of it. It's kind of interesting that you point out that like, to most people, you know, now don't have that frame of reference. And to them, that cliffhanger ending, that absurd, the characters in a death trap that they're going to get out of in the first scene of the next episode because we need a cliffhanger, is not a homage to a, like an art form from the 40s. It's something that they associate ineffably with Batman, yeah. You know, Batman 66. And it's kind of one of those things where the parody of the thing has almost replaced the original thing itself, which is absolutely fascinating. But I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that's taken wholesale from the comic books in terms of like, there are very few comic book adaptations that are, that as accurately portray like the appearances of, say, the villains who look like they literally wandered out of a comic book. Like, even things like, you could argue the Dutch angle that the series is famous for, the tilting of the camera, you know, is designed to draw your attention to the frame in a way that like emphasizes the idea of like watching, reading a comic book panel. The onomatopoeia, you know, the pow, boom, quiff stuff, clunk or ow or splash. Curse Splash, I think, is my favorite one of the ones in this movie. Yeah. But like, the, that's all taken again from comic books. It's designed to emulate the visual language of comic books. The use of bright colors in there as well. The narration, which captures like the narration boxes. You know, obviously it's not as stylized as, say, modern examples like Ang Lee's Hulk or Into the Spider-Verse more recently. But it does, in a weird way, Batman 66, the TV show and the film, arguably seem to, you know, to me, seem closer to the essence of a comic book than a lot of the movies that we got in between. And I include in that, say, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I include in that, obviously, the Nolan Batman movies, the Tim Burton Batman movies. But this sort of adaptation of style and tone rather than literal continuity from the comic books, which I think is massively underrated when comic book fans talk about Batman, you know, 66 in terms of like a document. It's just, it's amazing to watch because it's like a comic book brought to life, a Silver Age comic book. And those things are insane.
Well, no, I was going to say much the same about the style on display in this film, but, you know, it did seem a very appropriate way to me of using cinematic style to create this comic book-esque aesthetic. And you mentioned all the things I was going to flag up there, so the voiceover and the off-kilter angles and onomatopoeia and the colours, and I'd also add like the undercranked kind of car footage that gives this impression of speed that they do as well. But also like the production design, like it's not quite on the level of like the Ken Adam James Bond designs, I don't think, but you know, the Batcave and stuff's really impressive, I think, in this film.
There is indeed, and it sort of, it reminds me a bit of, and again, a large part of that is down to the fact that, the you know, it's operating on a budget. You know, again, like this is, I know this is a feature film adaptation of the show and it has a slightly bigger budget, but it's still operating on a budget that's relatively small by the standards of the time. And you have this sort of thing where you have to improvise and make do. And it's part of, Batman 66 is part of like a larger movement, I think, in the 60s in terms of, because I know that, you know, we talk a lot about, like, we talk about Gilda and stuff from the 40s and the 50s and that, and the 30s and that sort of context. But in terms of like the 60s, you had this kind of pop, kind of Andy Warhol's aesthetic, this embrace of absurdism and abstractism in terms of art. And I think of, for example, and a lot of this was obviously driven by cost, you know, to a certain extent, which is like, you know, we can't build a set, so have a wall and shine a brightly colored light on it. One of my favorite scenes from Star Trek is the sequence in, I think it's a Dagger of the Mind, where Kirk takes a woman on the tour of the Enterprise and pauses to look at a wall with a green spotlight on it. It's that sort of like minimalist design, but there's emphasis on color that gets you things that, along with sort of more kind of abstract narrative experiments, like say The Prisoner, gives you things like, say, Doctor Who on British television in the 60s, stuff like the original series of Star Trek on American television during the 60s, The Avengers on American television, sorry, on British and American television in the 60s. And I think that Batman 66 sort of belongs to that school of kind of like production design, where it's more, it's less obviously naturalistic than a lot of more modern stuff is, but it's also more willing to embrace kind of this absurdity, where like everything looks like a stage, everything looks like a set. And again, like watching it in high definition is amazing, because you can see like the fight on the submarine at the climax on the deck of the submarine, that's shot in a water tank, which is something you don't do anymore. Doesn't look kind of real per se, but it looks like a recreation. It has this sort of like a facsimile of this thing, and it's kind of, it creates this like level of unreality which is just stunning, kind of fascinating to be to watch as kind of as an aesthetic.
Yeah, now overall I think this film was a lot of fun. You know, it was a real pleasure to go back and watch it again for the first time in I'm not quite sure how many years. I'm not sure it's as good a film as the 1960s Batman is as a TV series, if that makes sense. So I said, like, in the book it's in the book I quoted it's 82nd. I'd be a bit surprised to see the film on a you know, 82nd on a list of great movies or whatever. But, you know, so I wouldn't have been upset if this film was a tad shorter. I mean, at 100 minutes, it's a lot shorter than a lot of superhero films, but maybe it could have been a tad shorter. I enjoyed it, brought back some fond memories. I suppose the question is, like, what's the film doing here that the TV show couldn't? And it seems to me there is maybe a greater sense of scale, you know, obviously some location shooting in a Gotham City that looks a lot like California. But there is actually a bit of a sense of spectacle to things like the sequence with the yacht that they fly out to. Obviously, it's kind of undercut when the shark appears and stuff like that. But yeah, so a sense of spectacle. Also, you know, it seems like they're making use of a greater like range of vehicles than I seem to remember being used in the series, that's right.
The speedboat as well. Like, the speedboat is something that you couldn't do on a weekly sort of budget, a weekly production budget and schedule. So you have stuff like that wonderful aerial shot of the boat circling just because it can, which seems to have inspired the entire third act of Batman Forever, I suspect. But again, like, you're entirely right, by the way. Like, there's an aspect of Batman 66 that works a lot better as a TV show than it does as a movie. And I think you're right about the length of it, because like, if you watch the movie, it feels particularly episodic in terms of things that happen. Like, it's four or five different little subplots that have been stitched together. You know, it's a number of sequences rather than an actual story. So, you know, there's there's a sequence involving the poor noble porpoise, that great torpedo sequence. There's the moment where Bruce Wayne is kidnapped and they're waiting for Batman, which is like a great hook. It's one of those great sort of like superhero tropes. And also Bruce Wayne has been kidnapped because he's fallen in love with Catwoman, which is again another one of those great tropes. But you have like him fighting and escaping and then sort of going away and then he comes back. And like, in terms of plotting, it's not ideal because you have the whole sequence with the Penguin going to the Batcave. And these elements all work rather well when you break them down individually, like as set pieces. So like, I love the sequence where Bruce Wayne, with his hands tied behind his back, takes on all four of the big rogues and their henchmen. Or I love the sequence where, like, after coming back, sometimes you can't get rid of a bomb. Or yeah. Like, and I love the sequence of like the penguin trying desperately to maintain his cover, and Batman, who for some reason couldn't see through Catwoman's disguise, is like, yep, definitely the penguin, but I'm going to invite him to the Batcave anyway. I don't see how this could go horribly wrong. I enjoyed that whole shtick. But again, it feels very much like in the TV show, you have at least the episode structure. So when you're doing these familiar elements that are structured apart, at least you're watching them separately. I think they aired on Wednesday night and Thursday night. And that feels like, okay, so you can break that up. Whereas if you're watching it in a movie, it's just a concentrated string of things happening. Now, I adore this movie, to be absolutely clear. Like, and I love it every time that I watch it. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that, you're right, it doesn't really work as a movie, as like an actual plot. Explain to me the plot of Batman 66 in 100 words or less. Or like, you know, on my podcast, the one I host with Andrew, where we ask the question, what is this movie about for you? I'm like, I dread the day when someone asks me, what is Batman 66 the movie about for you, Darren? And I have to try and summarize it. Because it's full of things that I adore. I'm not sure that it's actually functionally a movie, if that makes sense.
Well, no, here's the thing that I think there's maybe a sense of like diminishing returns where, you know, it's very funny the first time you see them drop down that pole and they flick the instant costume change switch or whatever it is. But you see that I don't know how many times through the film. You obviously hear Robin do the holy barracuda or whatever thing again and again. So maybe that just gets a bit wearisome. But I think the film always kind of brings it back. Like you say, the sequence with the bomb kind of revived my interest. And there are all these great sequences that come in. Yeah. Now, what about Adam West? So it strikes me that, like, you know, if we think of like film stars, you know, the big film stars, in many cases, they're linked to like, you know, a series of roles. But you get these people who come along who are defined by television stardom. Genuine television stars. They often come along, they're closely identified for the rest of their careers or the rest of their lives even with just one role in particular. And maybe West is somebody like that to an extent. You know, these people may have done other things. They might have done very accomplished things, but they have this signature role. It's always like the backbone of their image. And maybe West is a guy like that. You know, he appears to have done lots of things that play off of his role as Batman. Although I guess maybe for a lot of younger viewers, he'd be maybe more familiar for voiceover work where he plays himself. You know, he turns up in The Simpsons and Family Guy. I think in Family Guy, he's Mayor Adam West, isn't he? But,
yeah.
You know, Batman was the thing for him, wasn't it? Batman was his kind of, the thing he'll be remembered for, I suppose.
It is. And I mean, like, it's worth noting that there are two things about this which are rather unfortunate. The first unfortunate thing is the fact that the series as a whole is very villain-centric. Like, every episode is built around a special guest villain. And I suspect we might talk in a moment maybe about the use of the villains in this film.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a sense that, like, Adam West didn't always get to be the star in his own show in a way that he might have been. That it's that criticism that's leveled at Michael Keaton as well, where it's like in the Tim Burton Batman movies, Batman occasionally feels like a guest star. Now, I think Keaton does tremendous work, and I think West does tremendous work as well, but I think that that's the reason why sometimes he's sort of overlooked. There's also a sense that, like, the shame that was attached to, that I sort of alluded to earlier, that a certain sense of, like, fandom had towards Batman 66 sort of latched on to Adam West, where you had this whole thing. And again, you see a lot of it sometimes in Star Trek as well, with, say, William Shatner's performances, which, you know, are sort of occasionally very campy and turned up to 11. And there's a real sort of like cringe factor, a sense of almost embarrassment in certain sections of fandom about that. Now, I'm a huge fan of William Shatner. There's that great quote from Ethan Hawke, the actor, like when he was asked, you know, so who's your favorite actor working today, Mr. Hawke? And Hawke, who like, again, does wonderful things with these softball questions, is like, oh yeah, it's definitely Nicolas Cage. It's got to be Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage is the only person who's doing something interesting with the art form. You know, he's the best actor since Brando. He's what I think the ancient troubadours wanted to be. And I have that sort of soft spot for that approach to acting as something that's highly stylized and something that's sort of like not naturalistic in form. And Adam West sort of has that in spades, where West is this incredible, gifted, deadpan, comedic performer. And he plays all of these beats amazingly well. And Batman 66 would not work without him, because he works when you're a kid watching it, Batman as the straight-laced, like, virtuous, upright, heroic figure. You know, this is a version of Batman who is more heroic than, you know, Christopher Reeve's Superman, which is almost impossible to imagine as a kid. And then you watch it as an adult, and like underneath that you have this idea of Batman as a character who's this kind of kid who never really grew up and has no idea of like the world that he's navigating. So you have, for example, the sequence where, you know, at the press conference, where they're asked, like, would you mind removing your mask for a photograph? And it's, like, Commissioner Gordon who has to step in and say, no, 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 they have to protect their secret identities. Or you have this kind of, like, willful obliviousness to, like, the sexy Russian journalist who's taken a unique interest in him, who keeps saying, perfect. And he's like, I wonder where she's gone. Why is Catwoman here now all of a sudden? And he kind of has this, like, naive innocence to him that's almost impressive. And underneath that, again, you have a layer of Wes sort of camping it up. You have that wonderful sequence where they're riding in the horse and carriage, where, like, again, this is something that as a kid went way over my head, where he's talking about the dream that he's having, and he says, it approaches a climax, to which Catwoman responds, her eyes closed, no, not yet, not so fast. And I remember, as a kid, that went way over my head, but you have Adam West and Meriwether doing this sort of thing that is just incredible to watch, camping it up and sort of like laughing with the material in a way that's playful and inventive and sort of incredibly fun to watch.
Yeah, I was surprised how kind of amorous he was, actually. I didn't remember that. But I'll tell you, one thing I like about him is the sense of, you know, it's quite an endearing sense of physicality, I think, you know. And to be fair, the film often emphasizes it. You know, I suppose the stunt doubles come in at some point, but, you know, you get these long shots where like Batman and Robin run down a dock and drop down the pole or whatever and get in a speedboat. And I think perhaps I like it so much because I think Adam West's physicality that we see here seems to me like quite an achievable one.
As opposed to lugging a tire through a giant cave exactly. That you built onto your mansion while being haunted by dreams of a monster that lives in your parents' graves. I love Ben Affleck's Batman to a certain extent, but yeah, Adam West is much more achievable. And I mean, if you want to talk in terms of physicality, again, that sequence where Bruce Wayne, not Batman, takes on the entire rogues gallery with his hands literally tied behind his back, which is, it's a great sequence in terms of like choreography. Now, it is a bit campy, sort of like television show sort of stuff where they're smashing chairs and everybody's recoiling from punches that are several inches away from their face. But if you look at what West is doing sort of almost like sort of Zucker Brothers sort of comedy where like he's getting thrown down. There's a moment where he gets thrown down behind the sort of vanity sort of case. And he sort of pops back up again as if like he's spring loaded and ready to go. And it's just, I love that aspect of West Batman, which plays very well against like that physical elasticity with the kind of deadpan delivery where like there's a wonderful moment where like after they've killed the goons, so the goons in the cave, you know, the goons in the cave, who get infused with heavy water, but who basically explode at touch. And there's a moment where like after the goons have sort of evaporated, Batman and Robin sort of pause to reflect on that. And Robin's like, you mean they won't be coming back? And like, Wes takes this like absurd comic beat where a bunch of like literally heavies have shown up and tried to menace him in the Batcave before popping because they were mixed with the wrong kind of water, and earnestly delivers the line, not in this universe. And there's a sense that like Batman mourns the passing of even expendable goons. And it's kind of like, it's so camp, but so straight. There's that wonderful dichotomy that just works beautifully, I think.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, sometimes there's a sense that maybe Batman or Adam West can be kind of overshadowed on his own show because you've got such kind of colourful villains. And, you know, it seems especially applicable to this film, which features kind of an excess of roguery, doesn't it, really? And I love that scene where they're talking about it. They've solved the riddle. The riddle they solve is hilarious in itself. But
took place at sea. Yeah. Sea. Catwoman. It all adds up to a sinister riddle. Riddler!
Also, that sequence where they talk about what their objective must be, the villains, and you know, take over what? Gotham City? Any two of them would try that. The whole country? If it were three of them, I would say yes. But four? Their minimum objective must be the entire world. So, you know, this seems to be one of the things that's different from the TV show, I guess, is I can't quite remember, but I guess you didn't have the villains together so often. I'm guessing they were kind of kept separate, but here you've got all of them, of course, and played by some pretty accomplished performers, I think.
Yeah, played by some absolutely amazing performers. In terms of, and again, like you talk about the influence that these characters have had on there. Like, I mean, the Catwoman, the version of Catwoman that appears here, who is much more cat obsessed than her comic book counterpart. Like, the joke of Catwoman is she's a cat burglar, not that she loves cats. But again, that plays into Batman Returns, where she all of a sudden is resurrected by magic cat gods, for example. But you also have things like the Penguin with its wah 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 sort of quality to it, which is great. You have, like, interestingly enough, like, the character, the version of the character who's least influential, and it's kind of almost disappointing in a way, is Cesar Romero's Joker. He's the version of the character, he's the, like, the comic book villain who had the least impact of the iteration seen in this film. Because, like, it's kind of interesting when you watch it, because it almost seems like the Joker is, like, the friendly one of the set. He's the one who gets on easily with most people. He's the one, like, he's not jockeying to control the group, like, say, the Riddler or Penguin, and Catwoman sort of has her own thing going on. Joker seems just happy to be there and doesn't want anybody fighting. There's a moment where they're breaking into the UN, and Joker very sincerely asks, I hope Penguin's okay. And you're like, aww. Again, I love the fact, again, Cesar Romero's makeup, because he couldn't shave his famous mustache, white powder over his mustache, that you, I'm not sure if I could see at the time, but on high definition, it very much sort of shows up. And again, all of these characters are relatively well-defined, but the most influential one is the Riddler, played by Frank Gorshin, who was famously, I think he was the biggest Batman fan in the cast. When they did a bunch of publicity for the movie, himself and Adam West would literally tour the country with the film to announce it and to do publicity gigs. Gorshin, famously, he had a song, he has like his own Riddler theme song that he performed. I can't remember on which variety show it was, but it's worth seeking out on YouTube. It is amazing to behold. And Gorshin is kind of the character, the actor who is most influential, kind of, I think, in terms of defining like a Batman villain in general. It's worth noting the character of the Riddler. Everybody thinks of the Riddler as a big Batman villain. He famously featured in Batman Forever, played by Jim Carrey. Batman the Animated Series, and like all the time, whenever like the Nolan was going to do The Dark Knight Rises, there was this big rumor that it was going to be the Riddler, and it was going to be David Tennant, or it was going to be, you know, sort of Edward Norton, or it was going to be Eddie Murphy or something like that. And, you know, it never materialized. But there's this, like, the sense that the Riddler is one of the big Batman villains. The reason that is entirely down to Gorshin. Like, all the other Batman villains featured here, Catwoman, Penguin, Joker, they all date back to the earliest days of the Golden Age. In fact, the Joker and Catwoman both appeared in separate stories in Batman number one, the first like issue of Batman's self-titled comic book series. Penguin was introduced very shortly after that. The Riddler, on the other hand, is an interesting character because he had only appeared twice in comics before he appeared in this film and the first season of the TV show. And he was the villain who was chosen to host the pilot of the TV show. And he's the villain who is arguably most defined by, as he is in this film. And the thing about the Riddler is, and like, again, Batman 66, it's a very campy movie. It's a very silly movie. It has absolutely no internal logic. There's a moment where Batman phones up the Pentagon to complain about their selling of surplus naval issue submarines to people who don't even leave a forwarding address. But like, it's all very silly and goofy. But if you look at Gorshin's Riddler, there are a number of things which I find absolutely amazing. First of all, he's a lot more intense than any of the other villains around him. He's the villain who looks like he's having the least amount of fun and is most likely to take out a knife and stab somebody. In fact, like, of all the actors who have played Batman villains, he's perhaps the closest that's come to sort of Heath Ledger's intensity as the Joker, where there's this sort of like manic sort of sense that behind his eyes, he really, really, really doesn't see himself as crazy. He thinks the entire world is crazy and he's just trying to make sense. There's also this sense, this recurring sense, that he's almost a tragic figure. Like, again, like, this is Batman 66, so I'm not going to push this line too hard. But there's this sense of tragedy about the Riddler as he's portrayed in Batman 66. Because he's the one who's compelled to leave the clues. And again, this is something that becomes characterization of the Riddler later on, particularly in his comic book appearances in Batman the Animated Series as well, which is this idea that, like, he's a guy who's smart enough to complete all of these really great plans. And, like, by the way that stories are structured, if he didn't leave riddles, he would get away with them and Batman would never figure out he was responsible. There's a really, and again, I point to the Joker as like the most likable and lovable and like of the bunch, which is weird when you think of like later iterations as played by Jack Nicholson and played by Heath Ledger, that the Joker is like the fun, friendly kind of supervillain of the bunch. But you have the moment where after Penguin has like snuck into the Batcave with his goons and tried to murder Batman, the Riddler decides to sneak off and to launch a riddle into the sky in order to tease Batman. And the Joker tries to stop him, and the Joker makes two very logical arguments. First one is like, look, if Batman and Robin are dead, there's no point in doing this. Why on earth would you do this if Batman's not going to answer your riddle? And the second one is like, let's say the Penguin didn't kill them. Why in God's name, when we're trying to take over the world, would you pause to write a giant letter in the sky that would point directly to where we are conducting our evil secret plan to the one person who has continuously foiled us every moment up until this moment in time? And there's a moment there where the Riddler almost seems to like grasp like his weird fractured psyche, the tragedy of his being, the fact that if he didn't do this one very stupid thing every single time he completed a crime, maybe he'd be a bit more successful. And he shrugs it off and does it anyway. He literally runs off. And you see the Joker, and again, it's not murderous rage. The Joker's almost like disappointed. It's like watching a buddy make a bad life choice. He's like, I thought this time he'd do it. This time we'd do it without a riddle. Just this once. And I kind of like, I like that there's that element of it there, almost beneath the surface. And I kind of like, it, I'm not going to oversell it. I'm not going to say it's like the greatest drama ever told. But I kind of, I like that there's just that element underneath the surface if you're willing to poke at it. And I kind of, I love the Riddler as he's portrayed in the series, but particularly as he's portrayed here.
Yeah, well, I was pleasantly surprised that, as you say, the Joker is not kind of pulling the strings, not quite as prominent perhaps as the Riddler. But it seems just from, you know, a lot of the subsequent adaptations or iterations that they often seem to kind of tighten the duality between Batman and the Joker, don't they? And, you know, even like the recent Lego Batman movie kind of quite yeah, effectively kind of points to that as well, doesn't it?
Just in terms of that, it's worth noting in terms of comic books, like the Joker, again, this is Batman 66 as a product of its time in terms of comic books. The Joker at the time was largely a figure of fun because he couldn't be a murderous psychopath anymore. If you go back and look at the Golden Age of comics, in fact, his appearance in Batman number one, there's a lot of the Nolan Batman, the Nolan Joker in there. You know, there's the announcing that he's going to kill a bunch of people, and then he kills a bunch of people, and Batman has to stop him. And maybe Batman's too late a lot of the times that he does it. And they're all horrific, gruesome deaths, which is very much in the style of The Dark Knight. This, like, darker and edgier Joker. And then when, as I pointed out, you get that sort of, like, comics code authority, like, obviously you soften all of Batman's villains in general, but the one you soften most is the murderous clown who leaves dead corpses with Richter grins on their faces. So you have the Joker becoming this figure of fun, and you have like that, the meme of like, oh, Batman will never get my boner. That sort of quality where he's playing all these hilarious pranks. You know, there's the 1950s comic where like the Joker's big plan is to launch a pie in Batman's face. And again, like he was reinvented in the 70s by, I think, writer Denny O'Neill and artist Neil Adams and also Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers in, I think, The Joker's Five-Way Revenge, which was the Adams and O'Neill one. And I think The Laughing Fish, which was the Englehart and Rogers comic. But they're the ones in the 70s that sort of turned the Joker back into this murderous, monstrous fiend. One of them involves Batman riding a shark. So I wholeheartedly recommend that comic. And the other is one of those kind of gritty prototype sort of like somebody's murdering their way through Gotham's underworld. And like in the mid 1970s, where the Joker has been a figure of fun for so long, the big twist is, oh my God, the Joker's a killer clown. Now you're reading it and going, well, it's going to be the Joker, isn't it? And kind of like, it's interesting how the character's portrayal has shifted over time. And I do miss Cesar Romero's sort of version of the character, the sort of innocence of it almost. The kind of the fact that he's just there and he's kind of having fun. He's living his best life.
Yeah, I liked it. I really did. And one thing I wanted to mention before we move on, perhaps, is, you know, you mentioned the UN earlier. Well, it's actually the United World Organization, isn't it? But it's the United Nations by any other name. And I actually really enjoyed the presentation of that body because it reminded me of, we looked at The Day the Earth Stood Still on the podcast last year, you know, for the sci-fi film from the mid-50s, and the sort of there's like a UN organization in that film too, and again, it's dysfunctional, and it kind of strikes a chord a bit these days, I think. I don't want to you know, attribute too much to Batman 66 or whatever, but...
Carl, let me get this straight. Are you saying that the Batman 66 caused Brexit? Is that where this argument's going?
Not Brexit, but like the UN Security Council, you know, often these days it seems kind of deadlocked on key issues. And that's kind of how it's presented in this film, isn't it? They're always kind of squabbling. You actually mentioned earlier, you know, there is this sense that institutions and individuals within institutions in this film are quite ineffective. Like you mentioned the Admiral, didn't you? The one who sells the submarine back to the villains or whatever.
And you have the president stealing credit. They've done it. And then he announces, we've done it. And you have this kind of really sarcastic edge to it where you have, and again, this is a sense of like poking fun. Cause like, and you point out that as a kid, you're watching it and you're thinking Batman is the coolest ever. He's got a helicopter on top of like the Gotham City Police Department. You know, when he flies by, people in uniform stop and salute him, for example, that sort of thing's going on. He holds press conferences where he's so busy that he can only take a handful of questions. So please, please, please be careful. And like underneath all of that, you do have this sort of level of poking fun at the way things are. And like Batman is very much like there's a countercultural strain to like the Batman 60s TV show that runs through it, through obviously presenting Batman like as a figure of the establishment, like, but also through like this portrayal of like the Gotham City Police Department as characters who couldn't navigate their way out of a wet paper bag without a dude who dresses like a bat to help them. You know, that sort of quality to it. There's the, yeah, you pointed out the US military selling, you know, surplus equipment to people who don't even leave a proper address, who leave a PO box. That sort of quality, which again speaks to, again, it's the late 60s. It's the time where, you know, Kennedy has just been assassinated. You have Vietnam is sort of, you know, getting ready to heat up in the background. You have this sense of like, you know, the counterculture is emerging. You haven't yet had the Summer of Love. You haven't yet had the Manson family murders. You haven't yet had this explosion of everything that's simmering beneath the surface. But you have this tension in American culture around like what's happening, where do we go, how do we make sense of it? The world is changing so fast that we've got no frame of reference for it. And like watching Batman 66, there's a real sense of, well, you know, I don't want to present it as an overly serious exploration of world issues. It does tap into that sense of the world as a very weird, confusing and eccentric place in which like the established order of things doesn't always make sense, and sometimes the guy dressed in a cowl and a cape carrying a giant bomb through the Docklands is probably, you know, he's the straightest guy in the room. I kind of, yeah, it's a very strange dynamic, and I kind of like it. I think it's aged rather well in that respect.
Yeah, I think so too, because to go back again to Matt Zoller-Seitz, he says, you know, Batman is like the series creators had taken the establishment's fantasy of itself and dolled it up in tights and a cape. And, you know, I saw a couple of other reviews where they mentioned the Dragnet character, Joe Friday, and they compared Batman to him. And in this film, you know, we see, don't we, like they're very careful to include like an insert shot of Batman and Robin buckling their seatbelts, for example.
Yeah.
There's also a moment where they kind of take a time out to deliver an anti-alcohol message. And I think my favorite line in the film might be, they may be drinkers, Robin, but they're also human beings.
There's also the moment where, like, during the press conference, where, you know, they're asked, you're like the masked vigilantes in the Westerns. No. And Gordon gets really offended at this implication. Of course not. Batman and Robin are fully deputized agents of the law. And Robin turns to the police camera and says, support your local police force. And you have even like the intro text as well, which plays this ridiculously straight, yes, which is like, this is dedicated to the lovers of law and order and sort of like structure. And, you know, it's kind of like it begins as this very earnest, like support the troops, support law enforcement, you know, sort of message. And then at the end, you have this punchline, and also to any other lovers that we might have missed as well, while two people kiss at the edge of the frame. And that immediately establishes the tone of, well, look, this is very straight and very earnest, but is it really arched eyebrow? And I kind of, it's playful. And again, I feel like this is the thing where you watch it as a kid and all that stuff goes over your head because you're like, wow, there's a batcopter. Wow, there's a bat bike. Wow, there's a bat. It's a bat shark repellent. Whereas an adult, you're watching it and you're going, wow, Batman really does have free reign of Gotham City, doesn't he?
But maybe it's possible to go too far, you know, as a viewer in that direction, you know, because I think of Batman, he says at one point, doesn't he, there's always hope, you know, and there are these little things through the film where, you know, amidst all the comedy and the silliness, there are these other things which allow us to see him as kind of a genuinely reassuring figure, it seems. Yeah. So there's this, yeah, there's a weird kind of interplay, I think.
There is. And I mean, like, he's very much like, again, this is the thing where, like, as much as the show might occasionally laugh at Batman, he is very much the hero of the piece. He's very, like, even when he's duped by Catwoman, and the joke is to a certain extent on him because, you know, it's an obvious disguise. There's also a sense that, like, he genuinely cares for this woman who he thinks exists, and he's genuinely worried about her, and there's something pure in that. I mean, even the sequence where Robin is eavesdropping on their date and turns it off because, you know, discretion, you know, sort of like, you know, discretion is sometimes as important as valor. Alfred, who is wearing a domino mask, by the way.
That's right.
But like this idea that like there is, it's absurdly, cartoonishly, cheesily wholesome. But also underneath that, there's a sense that some of it is earnest and some of it is well meant. And like as goofy as it might be and as self-aware as it might be. And again, this is the thing where like a lot of the stuff is, I'm not a big fan of the humor in modern comic book films, largely as a result of like the work of Joss Whedon. And I love Joss Whedon's work in general. But like in terms of comic book films, there's a lot of stuff in the Marvel movies where you have the jokes that largely exist. And I think one of my friends pointed this out. He's Luke Dunn. He's a blogger in Ireland. He pointed out that a lot of the humor in modern comic book films comes from a sense of, well, we made the joke, so you don't have to. So it's like, well, this is a sure a goofy thing that we're doing. We're saying it now in the movie, so you people on the internet can't complain about it and laugh at us, which doesn't really work for me. But the jokes here, while they are a little bit self-aware, they're always in a way that never undercuts that. Like, as a kid, you're never taken out of the movie by the jokes, even if you get them as an adult, which I really, it's a very fine line to walk, but I think the movie does it. I think the show does it as well.
All right, so let's think a little about, you know, beyond the 60s for Batman. So you sort of mentioned earlier there's this kind of weird relationship some Batman fans have with Adam West's Batman. So does this kind of sense, like kind of a cautious mediation going forward, is there, where there's this 60s Batman thing which had a cultural presence, but maybe in ways that are somewhat regrettable for some fans, is it? And I wondered if like one area that manifests is in terms of like Robin going forward, because it seems to me, you know, he seems to be omitted from some of the subsequent films and so on. He does come back, of course, but that's an area where, you know, maybe you can see the effect of the 60s stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, even in the comic books, like during the 70s, you had, again, O'Neill and Adams, who were very much like for pushing this darker version of Batman in the 70s that led to Frank Miller stuff in the 80s. You had them writing a comic where like Robin, you know, where Robin goes to college in the 70s. So Dick Grayson, you know, Dick Grayson's gone. Batman is sort of by himself. You have in the 80s, you have Frank Miller writing Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, where Robin died and that sort of drove Batman to retirement. You also have, like, at the same time, they bring in a replacement Robin called Jason Todd, who is famously killed off in a phone-in vote held by fans. He's beaten to death by the Joker with a crowbar because comics aren't just for kids anymore. And again, in the 80s, you have this sort of shifting sense of, like, who the market for comics is. And again, there are larger factors at play here in terms of stuff like the direct market that I would use to bore your listeners to tears. But what you have is the sort of erosion of the idea of comics as something that are sold like in convenience stores and grocery stores off stands to kids, and they start becoming specialty items. And if they become specialty items, they become more expensive and they become more exclusive. As a result of that, their audience becomes older and more particular and more rigidly defined in what they want. The circulation of comic books as they exist today is a mere fraction of what they would have been back at the height and the boom in the, you know, back in the 40s, obviously, even the 60s. And I mean, there was a mini boom in the 90s, but that was largely driven by speculation. And that led to a huge bust from which the industry is still struggling to recover. But you had this shift in the late 80s towards this idea of comics being written for adults. And again, a large part of that is great. There's a whole host of work in the 80s that I adore in terms of, like, I'm thinking of Alan Moore's work on Swamp Thing, Frank Miller's work on Daredevil, even the emergence of, like, Vertigo at DC's publishing with characters like John Constantine and Hellblazer, but even, like, stuff like Neil Gaiman's The Sandman, which is one of the great sort of comic books that's a wonderful one to read as, like, a teenager going into adulthood. And you have Batman himself getting progressively darker as it goes. You have, like, The Dark Knight Returns, which is a movie about Batman who has retired, but who has this death wish. And Frank Miller very specifically writes it in a way that parodies Adam West. If you read The Dark Knight Returns, it's very clear that he's beginning as Adam West Batman, and he's turning into something decidedly darker and decidedly monstrous as he goes. And, like, you'll notice in the way that Frank Miller illustrates him, he starts out wearing, like, the blue cape and the yellow sort of signal on his chest. And as the comic book goes on, he gets a bit more darker, a bit more edgier, and starts to look, ironically enough, a bit more like the Nolan Batman or the Batman from Batman vs. Superman. This sort of darker, more modern take on the character. And at the same time, you have, like, in the late 80s, you have Tim Burton coming and doing a Batman movie. And that Batman movie is dark. Again, you have Batman wearing black leather, but you have this gothic fantasia running through it. You have the Joker being incredibly, incredibly murderous. You have Batman literally sleeping upside down like a bat. Yeah. That sort of quality to it. And again, like, this is the thing where I think that I love the Burton movies, and I think there's a campiness that runs through them that wasn't appreciated at the time, and maybe still isn't, in that, like, Burton's very clearly having fun with the character, but in a way that Burton does where you might mistake it for being dark. Yeah. But it's very much in some ways a rejection of that lighter, campier aesthetic of, like, Batman 66. And even, like, the Batman the Animated Series, which, again, was written by people who loved Batman in general, including Batman 66. Wonderful, touching episode starring Adam West. Which is the Grey Ghost, Beware the Grey Ghost, which is very much about Batman fans trying to make peace with 1966. It's about Bruce Wayne, who had this TV show that he loved as a kid, and he meets the actor from it, who's this sort of eccentric old man who's sort of campy and silly, and he begins to question whether or not this person might be involved in some shady activities, and he sort of has this anxiety about this character that he worshipped as a boy. And eventually comes around to reconciling with him in a very touching sort of way, which kind of literalizes that fear that runs through sort of Batman fandom. Because there's this fear about not being taken seriously. And again, I think it informs a lot of pop culture in general. It's not just Batman or even just comic books in particular. But there's a weird sense when you talk about things that are beloved. And again, I mentioned the Star Trek example, where there's a sense that if you're not taking it entirely painstakingly seriously earnestly, you're not doing it right. Or people are worried that you're laughing at them, or it's a joke, or you're making fun of them. And people, there's a sensitivity that happens, and it happens a lot with, say, I mentioned the discussion of Shatner's performance in the original 1960s Star Trek, which is hyper-stylized. It's heightened. It's absurd. Yeah. It's ridiculous. But he knows exactly what he's doing, and it's a joy to watch on that level. But people are very sensitive about that when you come to talking about, like, Star Trek as a cultural artifact. And there's a sense that if you're critical of that, or if you discuss it in that way, that you're diminishing it. And there's a sense of that with Batman 66, or there was a sense of that. Now, I think culture has moved a little bit away from that, and I'm very, very glad of that. There's been a lot of work, particularly in recent years, towards rehabilitating Batman 66 in the cultural memory. So I'm thinking, for example, of The Brave and the Bold, the animated TV show. Yeah. Which is adorable. It's amazing. It features the best version of Aquaman ever. It's outrageously fun. It has basically, it's this camp sort of 1960s version of Batman, this sort of Dudley Do-Right straight man who goes on crazy adventures with his friends, and it's great fun. You have, like, the Batman 66 comic, which was published online by DC, which features this range of artwork and sort of offers a continuation, a celebration of the 1960s Batman, which is just lovely and a joy from beginning to end. But you also even have, like, this sort of almost counterpush against being darker and edgier in film, which I'm of two minds about, like, where you have this reaction against, say, Batman versus Superman or Man of Steel, where it's like, it doesn't have to be dark for you to take it seriously. And that's entirely valid. Comic book movies don't have to be dark to be taken seriously. But you also, it's sometimes possible to take them seriously and do it well. I don't think that one approach is better than the other. I think that both approaches are valid if they're used well. But it's heartening to me to see that there is a sense that it's okay for Batman. Again, you reference Adam West appearing in The Simpsons as himself, referencing Batman. It feels like it's okay for Batman to dance again, and I'm really happy about that.
Well, let's come back to kind of where we started then, because we talked a bit about Black Panther at the outset. Kind of this issue of the cultural standing of the superhero film today. Because it seems to me like it's still in somewhat of a liminal state, in the sense that, you know, they clearly enjoy wide appeal. You know, Marvel films do gangbusters at the box office, for example. But maybe they still, a lot of these films lack the full-throated kind of critical or industrial endorsement or appreciation in a lot of cases. And of course, if we're speaking here, and if this episode goes out after Black Panther sweeps the Oscars or whatever, this is entirely moot. But You know what I mean? And some indications that it's changing, like Black Panther's nominations, but maybe there's still some way to go. And I wonder if what we're seeing is something that's played out, you know, in other ways before with other cultural forms. Because I read something recently, somebody called Nicholas Garnham was quoted. He said that, you know, when a medium declines from the height of its popularity, it's at that point it sort of becomes open to being appropriated by the middle classes. So the example he gives is like film studies only really took off in the 60s as like a discipline. And that was after kind of attendances had fallen. Cinema attendances in the US had kind of declined from their peak. People didn't really study TV shows until after the main networks lost their grip on mass audiences. So I wonder if we see the same sort of thing with genres. You know, like the Western these days is very respectable, I think. I'm not sure it always was so respectable in quite the same way. It seems like it's treated much more seriously as an artistic kind of artifact after its heyday. So yeah. I wonder if it's going to be the same with superhero films, that, you know, if the bubble bursts, if Marvel films aren't the big thing one day anymore, will that be the point at which people start going back to these films and giving them much more attention than I think a lot of critics and commentators have done up until now? I mean, it's not a binary thing, I don't think. I mean, it's like there were Westerns in the 40s that were taken very seriously indeed, but I mean, like, the genre as a whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it is worth noting that we're living in an era with a relative glut of superhero films. Now, I mean, you're talking, when you talk about the glut of Westerns in, like, the 30s and 40s, you're talking about 30, 40 films released every year because that was designed to fill cinemas that were operated by the movie studios, and so there was a constant churn, and you wanted a new movie every week. So, like, when people say that there's a glut of superhero movies now, they're not talking about that level of glut, but you're still talking at a stage where you're getting, you know, in the range of 5 to 10 of these gigantic tentpoles that are based on iconic properties. So there are a lot of superheroes out there at the moment, and there's an understandable wariness and anxiety about that, and I suspect a large part of why the Academy didn't nominate The Dark Knight was a sort of a I don't want to say snobbishness, but a wariness of what that would represent in terms of endorsing what is a very broad, very populist genre that is, you know, very much more commercially and sort of seen as being relatively juvenile. The thing with the Westerns, though, and it's kind of an interesting comparison, is that, and again, this is something that comes up a bit when you talk about superheroes in terms of, like, their place in American culture. I define, like, at the very start, I talked about Superman as, like, the iconic American sort of myth to a certain extent. And, like, writers like Grant Morrison, who is a comic book writer, and he did a fantastic run. He's done fantastic work with both Superman and Batman. He does very well with these characters who are particularly iconic. He's a Scottish writer. But he came up, he argues, again, and it's not a novel argument, but he argues that, like, superheroes are effectively a modern pop mythology, and that they represent sort of a mythic archetype that allow us to explore in abstract ideas that, you know, we're not necessarily comfortable talking about directly in a way that's populist and accessible. Like, so, for example, you mentioned Black Panther, which is, you know, it's a superhero movie. It hits all the beats of a Marvel film. In its own way, it's as formulaic as an episode of Batman 66. You know, you have the big throwdown CGI fight at the end, all that sort of stuff. You got the light jokes, you got the, you know, all that sort of stuff that's structured within it. But using that, you have this discussion of things like privilege and race in America and the legacy of violence and the cycles of violence and the idea of what it's like to identify as somebody who is black in a country that does not necessarily respect you and longing to connect spiritually, emotionally, and physically with an identity that extends beyond being American in the 21st century, which is a very profound thing culturally to argue. It's a very big idea to wrestle with. And it's kind of amazing to see a blockbuster that made all of the money kind of wrestling with these ideas with the character of Killmonger. But at the same time, the difference, and it's been pointed out, and I think it's a very credible argument, like, and as somebody who is prone to make those sort of like bold, abstract, mythological arguments, the difference between superheroes and mythology, and even between things like, say, the Westerns during the 30s and 40s, is that all of the big superhero identities are owned and copyrighted. In that the genre itself, you can have, obviously you have superhero movies that are not, you know, necessarily copyrighted. I'm thinking, for example, of movies like Chronicle, for example, Josh Trank's film, or even stuff like Defender starring Woody Harrelson, or Kick-Ass, you know, which is based on the Mark Miller comic and stuff like that. So you have, you know, comic book or superhero movies that exist outside of the major studio framework. But most of the big superheroes, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, X-Men, Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, etc., are all owned by corporate entities. Their images are controlled, their uses are highly regulated, and so you don't really have that level of dynamism that you might otherwise have. So, like, with a Western, And this is interesting that you talked about, like, as the form is eroding and, like, the democratization of film studies and stuff like that, and the idea that when a form collapses, it becomes accessible and you get people who do new and interesting things with them. I mean, you talk about the Western, you think about the work of, say, Sergio Leone, for example, Sam Peckinpah, yeah. These guys who are taking the form and doing interesting things with it, which never would have been possible using a framework that exists at the time. The issue with superheroes, and I'm kind of curious, I want to see how they're going to get around this, is the fact that all of these properties are owned by companies like Disney and like Time Warner. And so you have a much tighter grip on what you can and can't do with them. I love Logan a lot. I think Logan is fantastic. But again, it can't quite be Unforgiven. It can't quite commit to that level of deconstruction. I think in large part because it's part of the X-Men shared universe. It has to fit in some small way, shape, or form with this larger plan that's unfolding across several different media. And so there's not really the freedom to commit to doing what you could do if you were cut completely loose and that sort of stuff. And again, and this isn't just a studio thing as well. I worry a little bit about fandom in general. Because what I've seen emerge, and again, this happens, it's not just with superheroes and comic books, if you're arguing about modern mythologies, stuff like, say, Star Trek and Star Wars, is that you've had this creeping into the cultural conversation in recent years. This sort of almost conservatism in terms of defining what should and should not be done with these characters and properties. I mean, you saw a large part of the response to The Last Jedi was fans complaining that you couldn't, or you shouldn't do things that the writer and director Rian Johnson did with beloved characters like Luke, for example. And you have this sort of creeping in. I mean, I'd even argue that you see it with Batman versus Superman, which is a deeply, deeply, deeply flawed film. But it does something, it does a number of things that I think are genuinely interesting in terms of, like, exploring this idea of, like, xenophobia and of kind of panic and anxiety and of, like, racial uncertainty and wariness and the erosion of trust and the breakdown of social order, which I think it does those things much more interestingly than, say, the version of that story that you get in, say, Civil War, which was released at the same time, but which was much more popular, much more successful. And you have a reaction to that, which consists of, you can't do that with Batman and Superman. Why would you do that with Batman and Superman? You shouldn't be doing these things with these characters. And it kind of, you see the studios recoiling from that with stuff like Justice League, which is a much more conventional and pandering piece of cinema. It's much more conservative. It uses, for example, the Danny Elfman theme from the Tim Burton Batman movies. It uses the John Williams score from the Richard Donner Superman movies in order to, like, tickle the nostalgia buttons and to give you exactly what you expect. So, like, if we're worried about the future of, like, superheroes as a genre and, like, the need to push forward and to evolve, my big concern and my big anxiety, I don't doubt that we'll see it happen eventually somehow, but what I see as the barrier to that is this sort of conservatism in terms of ownership. And that ownership is both in terms of corporations, but also in terms of the fans who have these rigid ideas of what you can and can't do. Like, imagine if you were releasing Unforgiven and you had people who were saying, well, that's not like Rawhide. How can you make that? That doesn't reflect Rawhide. That's not a cowboy film. That would be a very strange situation to be in. And I feel like superhero movies need to figure out how to break out of that before they can do something like, say, Unforgiven.
Fascinating. Well, maybe in a few years we'll come back and maybe we'll discuss the 40s serial or something as a pretext to get back into these issues. But cheers, Darren. I mean, if people are fascinated by Batman, if they've checked out the 66 film and want to know more, or if they're strongly drawn to the Christopher Nolan films, for example, you've got a book out which might satisfy people in that respect, haven't you?
I do indeed. I have a book that covers the work of Christopher Nolan, including, so it goes film by film through his filmography, and it's got three chapters dedicated to his Batman trilogy, which are an astounding piece of work, both in terms of American popular cinema in the 2000s, and also just as Batman adaptations. I'm a huge Batman fan as well as a huge Nolan fan, so those are sort of big films for me. I think they account for about 30,000 of the book's 80,000 words, so there's a lot of meaty stuff in there, and I get into, I think, some of the stuff I talked about there about this idea of ownership and conservatism and the idea of what Nolan did with his Batman films that is different from what a lot of other studios do with their own superhero projects. So yeah, you can buy that online. That's available at Amazon. But if you don't want to shop at Amazon, and I understand people may have an objection to doing that, you can order it online from any bricks and mortar store, actually. They can order it and they can get it in for you. They can ship it in for you. But even if you want to, you can buy online digitally. There are digital copies available. And I mean, I understand that if it's an academic book in some respects, so it may be a bit pricey. If that's a concern, your local library also has a budget for these sort of things. So if you want to ask your local library to order it in for you as well, that would be very handy as well. So I mean, if you are interested in that, I would hope that you might find something worthwhile in there. That would be my hope.
Great stuff. And I think, Darren, if you're a Batman villain, I think your villain name might be Mr. IMDb, mightn't it, because of your other podcast. So how are things going at the 250 these days?
Yeah, where every week I kidnap Batman and I subject him to watching one of the movies on the bottom 100 until he breaks. As Carl mentioned, I co-host a podcast with my best friend Andrew Quinn, and we discuss one movie a week, and that movie is taken from either the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time or the bottom 100 as well. And actually, this may be an interesting forum to announce or to mention this. Myself and Andrew are doing a thing that is both very ambitious and also very stupid. We are hosting a live, again, inspired by our mutual friend Tony Black and the work that he did in the X-Cast, which you were very much involved in. But we're doing a live broadcast covering Twin Peaks The Return, which is named by Cahiers du Cinéma and Sight and Sound as the best movie of 2017. So we thought, hey, we'll take that seriously. We will discuss Twin Peaks The Return as a movie. Now, Carl, who has had the good or misfortune, depending on how he feels about it, to have appeared as a guest on our podcast, knows that we tend to talk a little bit longer about the films than most people. The joke is that, you know, our episodes tend to be about as long as the movies we're discussing. So we thought we would do a 16-hour live podcast covering Twin Peaks The Return with a whole bunch of guests to help us out, broadcasting on the 23rd of March, which is the day after Daffodil Day here in Ireland, which is a national holiday that we use to celebrate the Irish Cancer Society. So we'll be raising money, if you want to donate, to the Irish Cancer Society to help with research and support for people with cancer. I don't have the charity page set up as we're recording, but I will hopefully have it by the time this is released. But please, if you want to get the word out, or even if you want to support us, or even if you know somebody who's interested, or even if you just like Twin Peaks, we hope that might be of interest to you. Otherwise, we release episodes weekly Saturdays at 6 p.m.
Great stuff, Darren. Sounds like a fantastic endeavor. I'll definitely be tuning in because I'm a Twin Peaks fan as well. I'll definitely be spreading the word on social media too. It sounds like a great idea, really. So good luck with all of that. As for the podcast, find us in all the usual places online. We'll be back with another episode soon. So I hope you can join me next week when the back curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.